Oh, Brad, what have you done now?
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Brad Gilmore Show. Yes, and we're back here. I'm so excited to have the podcast back on a weekly basis for you all. I'm going to tell you where I've been here in a moment. But first, today's episode is brought to you by our great friends over at Loot Crate. Yes, if you don't know about Loot Crate, awesome stuff. They have the WWE Slam Box. They got all kinds of boxes where it sends you a great box of goodies every single month. So if you want to sign up, you can get 10% off today by using our code. So go to trylootcrate.com/BG show. That's trylootcrate.com/BG show. You get 10% off your new subscription. Click the link in our show notes. But hey, let's start the show. Yeah, let's do it. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. I am Brad Gilmore. Bam! It does feel great. No, it didn't feel great. It feels good to be back on the show. The Brad Gilmore Show has returned. I've been trying to figure out for several weeks what exactly I wanted to do, how to bring a podcast back. I've been gone from podcasting now, guys, if you can believe it, for over a year. I've, of course, done the Heated Conversations radio show and podcast with WWE Hall of Famer Booker T, and I did Your Opinion Doesn't Matter for a while, but I haven't had my own show, my own podcast, in quite some time, and I decided to return back. It was going to be Vegetables for Breakfast. It was going to be the name of this show. Last minute, something in me said to change it, so I did. And here we are back at the Brad Gilmore Show. If this is your first time listening to me, I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. I am Brad Gilmore, born and raised in Houston, Texas. Radio, television personality, musician. And I had the Brad Gilmore Show, which was a staple here in the Houston independent music scene for quite some time, for about 5 years. And I went away because I was working on stuff with Booker T and Reality of Wrestling and doing the European It Doesn't Matter show and doing the Back to the Future, the podcast, which I have some interesting news on as well on this show. And so I decided to step away from podcasting, my own show, my own podcast, not podcasting altogether. And but I just had that itch. I love talking to people. I love talking to people in fields that interest me. And I decided to bring back the show, and we're going to have a lot of really cool guests, like today's guest, Eric Zala, is amazing. He and his buddies they filmed and directed and wrote and this incredible shot-for-shot remake of Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark. And there's a documentary called Raiders about it, and it's just it's a phenomenal story, which we're going to get to, and I'm actually going to play something that's going to give you some more background on it. So we're going to talk to him today, and that's what I plan to do. I want to talk to people who interest me. Back when the Brad Gilmore Show first started, hip-hop was my only focus, only interest. So I talked to a lot of rappers from the city of Houston, and I plan on returning to that and talking to these rappers once again, talking to all musicians in the city, and not just musicians, filmmakers, actors, directors, professional wrestlers, comedians, writers, all kinds of people. Anybody who interests me, I plan on talking to on this podcast. And so I thought, why not start today, kick it off hot with Eric Zala. And we're going to be back, though, on a frequent basis, weekly basis, maybe even multiple shows a week. I'm not only going to interview people on this show. I'm going to have shows where I talk about pro wrestling. I'm going to have shows where I talk about anything that's going on, sports, the NBA playoffs, anything that comes to my brain that I want to do a podcast on, I'm going to, which actually leads me to my next announcement. Back to the Future, the podcast, is returning. I'm still debating on if it will have its own feed or be in this show feed, the Brad Gilmore Show feed. I'm leaning toward that. Y'all can let me know. But I'm really excited to be back, and I'm excited to be able to have a weekly form of self-expression and getting to know other people. That's always been my favorite thing about a podcast, is I always got to, you know, get to know other people and make connections, and we connect in so many different levels, but on a human level, and we express to each other things that interest us and excite us. So I'm really happy to be back. I hope that you all will listen to the show and welcome me back with open arms. Coming up on the show in the next couple weeks, I have Rex Andrews, the Reality Wrestling Texas champion. I have Avarius Us, who is releasing a brand new project called Contact. I have Joe Toplin, who used to write for Jay Leno, and David Letterman was the head writer of The Tonight Show and The Late Show, as well as working with Chevy Chase. I'm going to be talking to him and just a myriad of other people, Justin Roberts, Eric Zala today, so many different people from so many different walks of life. So I'm excited. I'm excited to be back on the air. Brad Gilmore Show, here we go. And by the way, real quick, side note, I'm going to be putting out classic episodes of the Brad Gilmore Show back on this feed as well for the people who've been long-term fans. But without further ado, I want to throw it to a little get-to-know-you package about our guest today, Eric Zala, the director and star of Raiders the Adaptation and Raiders, the story of the greatest fan film ever made. So right now, let's take a look back and get to know Eric Zala. Enjoy.
We met a pair of young movie makers who are filming their own version of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Their summer project is the subject of tonight's Page 13.
It's become a cult favorite.
They used real snakes, did their own stunts, and nearly burnt down their mom's house.
I don't know how to explain this, but it's Raiders of the Lost Ark remade shot for shot by 11-year-old kids in 1982.
I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it.
Just the idea that these two guys were able to make this movie over a period of 7 years, to me, is absolutely mind-boggling.
They were in college by the time it was finished.
Who's got that much time and energy?
The fact that they didn't burn down the house is a miracle.
Seems like a good example of bad parenting.
You're not just watching Raiders, you're rooting for the kids to succeed.
It was the best feeling I've ever had in my life. We kind of missed out on our childhood. But the whole time we realized we were filming our childhood.
Once that became part of their lives, it's almost as if they've never been able to shake it, even up until now.
After we finished, I would have a recurring dream that somewhere we would be shooting the airplane scene. On some level, it haunted me that we never did this.
The fact that I get to do this, shoot the airplane scene, and begin the adventure again.
You want to make God laugh. Tell him you have a plan.
It just slowly progressed downward.
Pretty dangerous today.
Pull the plug now or spend more money than you planned.
I don't think the words "you're going to be fired" were used.
Done. I will never work with that guy again.
You gave up, man. I'm sorry.
I don't want to be part of it.
I'm going to kill you.
Action. Francisco, stop.
3, 2, 1.
Oh, no.
The plane is supposed to go.
Eric Zala, ladies and gentlemen, joins me right now. Eric, Happy New Year. How are you doing?
Hey, Brad. I'm good, thanks. How about yourself?
Oh, I can't complain. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this for us. We're really excited to talk to you about just an incredible ride and an incredible story that you have and how you're tied into one of the most iconic franchises and the most iconic film in cinematic history, which, of course, is Raiders of the Lost Ark. Eric, let's go back to the early 80s when the movie was first released, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was released in theaters, and I believe you saw it in theaters. What was your experience with the film, your earliest memories?
This was summer of 1981, and, you know, I was a Star Wars fan, and I'd heard that the makers of Star Wars and Jaws teamed up to do this new movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I actually wasn't particularly excited to go see it. For some reason, I thought, you know, doesn't sound that hot. And I went, and I didn't know that movies could do that. I think about the time that the boulder scene happens and this colossal rock is barreling down on Indy, I couldn't believe it. It lit a fire that burns to this day. I didn't know it was possible to be transported, to be that excited, that thrilled by a movie. But it was it was a world I wanted to inhabit. And I had no idea, though, that it would change my life as much. But I remember that first screening distinctly. It was singular.
Now, for you, were you in school? You know, I know that you were into a lot of comic book characters. DC Comics was very big for you when you were in school, around the time the movie came out. Were you also big into history? Was it kind of a combination of, you know, comic book hero meets, you know, historical artifacts? Was that what the appeal was for you, or was it just this undying sense of adventure?
You know, that's a great question. You know, I think I had seen after Raiders some of the original 1930s serials on like PBS, I think, that they screen played for like this fundraiser. And actually, if you donated, you could get a special souvenir booklet of Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think. So they were making a direct connection. I think on some level, you know, my being exposed to that early, however rough, kind of B-movie serial, and yeah, certain elements probably in my comic book carriage that I'm probably not even aware of, you know, say battling the Nazis, whether it's Captain America or a, you know, bullwhip toting adventurer. It kind of does go similar places, you know, sense of adventure. Yeah, I think so. It, whatever, you know, this kind of cocktail of, you know, of kind of geeky obsessions, it was really, really powerful.
And, you know, for most people, you know, for me, my favorite movie of all time is Back to the Future, which is another Steven Spielberg produced film.
I love Back to the Future.
Oh, it's one of my favorites. It is my favorite of all time. But, you know, for me, when I saw the film for the very first time, I didn't think, let me go run out and recreate this movie. You know, that thought never occurred to me. My thought was, let me be a fan. Let me learn everything there is to know about the film. Let me watch it countless times on end. But it was never, let me go and create the film myself. What was it in you that sparked the idea to recreate the film, not only your own interpretation, but a shot-for-shot remake? What was the genesis of the idea?
You know, I cannot take credit for the idea. That credit goes to my Chris Drumpolis, who played our Indiana Jones. Chris initiated the project by actually giving me a call one summer afternoon, actually about a year after I saw Raiders. You know, we had ridden on the school bus together, and it's a long school bus, hour both ways. I'd do my homework on the way back or whatnot, but might be bored otherwise by finishing, and spotted this kid with this Raiders comic book. And I said, hey, can I borrow that? And he said, yeah, sure. Well, the kid was Chris, and I guess he remembered that, put it together. I was a Raiders fan, and I'd done a school project, you know, early in the school year, and Chris mistakenly thought I knew something about film. So that's what led to him looking me up in the phone book. This was 1982, and giving me a call and saying, hey, remember me? I'm that kid on the bus that borrowed the comic book. Anyway, I'm doing this shot-for-shot remake of Raiders Lost Ark. Do you want to help? And I, you know, I thought for all of 5 seconds, you know, I imagined all the sets built, everything, you know, handled. I just sort of walk onto the set and help. Little did I know, the only thing that Chris had done at that point was buy the published screenplay from Walden Books and cast himself as Indiana Jones, as any good producer will do. But we got together for a play date. You know, Chris was 11, I was 12. Came over to my mom's house, which had this big rambling basement. And, you know, I was showing Chris a tour. You know, I'd kind of done sort of, you know, built sets in the basement before, you know, haunted house kind of thing before, but nothing. You know, it seemed a perfect improvised soundstage, and it was there listening to bad horror movie sound effect records that the project was really formed. And Chris, well, this could be great. We could shoot in here, you know, and we had no idea how we were going to do it. And you know, I got questioned, could we? But kids don't know what kids can't do. And in our case, that was a real benefit. Had we known it would have taken 7 years, we would have been terrified. But we didn't, and decided to launch into the project, not knowing what we were getting into, and figuring it out as we went.
You know, for me though, even the thought of doing some sort of fan film, because fan films are something that I think have become a part of the culture in nowadays with media being so easy, you know, to obtain. You know, cameras now be on every cell phone. You know, people are shooting movies, full length films from their cellular device. Some of them are editing on the phone. Back in the early 80s, those technology wasn't as easily accessible as it is today. Was there ever any thought process into it that, like, okay, wait, I know they had a lot of money to build Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, they had a lot of, you know, cameras. They had actual actors. They had a director. They had people who did this for a living. None of that prevented you, or did you even think about it? Was it really just, I'm doing something with my friend Chris, and we're going to figure it out as we go along, and this is just going to be something that we work on for maybe a week or so, not anything more than that?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of a perfectionist by nature, kind of a finisher. You know, that was kind of what I brought to the table with Chris, you know, and we actually, you know, we kind of fumbled around in the dark in terms of, well, how do you remake a $22 million movie on your allowance, you know, and how do you make movies at all? This was, you know, yeah, pre-internet, and there were home camcorders were in their infancy, just basically just released to the consumer. You know, everyone was making the transition from Super 8 to, for the first time, convenient home video, rough as it was. Yeah. And we only had access to the, you know, ultimately after 7 years of editing by having a connection with the local TV station, we would have killed, you know, for the technology that you referenced. You know, it's available in any iPhone, you know, the ability to capture footage and edit it easily. Our editing was all nonlinear, but those challenges, I mean, I can say with perspective, probably in some ways were an aid, you know, that, you know, found over the years that obstacles and challenges actually spark creative solutions, which can be, you know, better than how you first planned it. I mean, one example of kind of a compromise that we thought at the time was, you know, in Raiders Lost Ark, there's the treacherous spider monkey that is eventually poisoned by the dates intended for Indian Sala. Well, I had storyboarded a kitten. We were going to use a kitten because, you know, spider monkeys, not too plentiful in Mississippi to us back then. And we wound up using Chris's dog, Snickers. And it kind of works, a boy and his dog. As awkward as it is to see Snick perched on his shoulder, having toured with the film as long as I have, folks, you know, that's one of the very favorite things about the film, was that substitution of a dog for a monkey. And it was because we didn't have a monkey, you know. So all of which is to say, I kind of sort of lucky in some ways to have been as challenged resource-wise as we were. I think it forced us to be, if low on budget, high on creativity.
No, 100% I agree with you. You know, I think one of my favorite quotes was from, you know, Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey said, sometimes ignorance sparks innovation. And I think that's maybe yeah, exactly what happened in that, you know, in that certain situation back in the early 80s. But, you know, you work on this thing for over 7 years. Throughout the course of that 7 years, there's another Indiana Jones film that comes out, Temple of Doom, obviously, which is a prequel. By the end of 89 or summer of 89, the Last Crusade comes out. So all this Indiana Jones kind of just consumed your life in the 80s. And for 7 years, this was the thing that you spent all your time on, every waking second, you know, all the summers with your friends, with your brother, who I know was involved and played several characters in the film, in the remake, that is. You know, with all of that going on, was it ever hard to stay focused on the film? you know, with life happening, going to school, friendships, you know, people coming in and out of your life, was it ever hard to stay 100% focused on the project?
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, you do change a little bit from age 12 to 19, right? And you know, I guess I'm sort of fortunate that time, 12 to 19, the 7 years it took for us to shoot it as kids, was bracketed actually by the original trilogy of Raiders, come to think of it, with Raiders on one side and Last Crusade coming out in 89, just in time to kind of push us through that last obstacle. Because, yeah, you know, it is tempting to give up, you know, over the 7 years. You change, you discover girls, you know, there's other competing things. For me, though, I mean, the challenge wasn't sticking with it so much. I mean, that was other people's challenges, but, you know, the differences between, you know, Chris and I, sometimes, you know, while sometimes a strength, you know, we each brought different things to the table, sometimes those differences conflicted, you know, and threatened to shut us down. You know, like Chris had a crush on Angela, our Marion, and struck up an off-screen romance. And I, as director, I'm horrified. I'm like, oh my God, this is this could end badly if they like break up and hit each other. We could shoot years with Angela and like not being able to use any of the footage. You know, and you know, we had an out and out falling out over, you know, my first high school sweetheart, Kathy, you know, and those kind of inner conflicts really were the biggest for me, is getting past the personalities and, you know, the, well, people challenges. The, you know, I think, and, but I'm, other, you know, at the same time, you know, other folks who maybe didn't love Spielberg and Raiders as much as we were ready to kind of throw in the towel sooner. And it's, you know, we saw a whole spectrum of involvement from the 60 or so neighborhood kids that, you know, were involved in some way, big or small, in the making of this film. Many hands, you know, from Alan Stenham, who was diehard, you know, came back year after year to play Sala, Angela Tews, who was a trooper, to like the kid that shows up once and it rained and felt that it was a drag and never showed up again and could never would return my phone calls, you know, and everything in between. you know, you have to push through when it's not fun, you know, anymore. And, you know, one, probably, I think, the most concrete example of that for us was, you know, I mentioned Chris and I's first Ice Age over a girl. The second one was actually, you know, when we almost didn't finish in 89, before Last Crusade came to kind of inspire Chris to try it again. There was something of an editing room mutiny. You know, we spent the whole final summer, or I should say second to last summer, editing the previous year's worth of footage. Got to picture lock, and Tristan and Jason didn't want to invest any more time in the sound and said, we're done, and we had a falling out over it and didn't talk. And so the film threatened to basically be unfinished, even as we were almost over the finish line. Of course, Last Crusade came out the following summer. I invited Chris. He got inspired over again, and we patched things up, went back in the editing room, added the music and the sound effects to make it complete, really, and we finished. But that story sort of illustrates that, yeah, sometimes it was a painful birth.
No, definitely, and I can understand that. You know, anything worth doing, though, is doing well, and it takes time and effort to complete a project such as that. But, you know, you have this film, you go back and edit it in the summer of 89 after Last Crusade comes out, and then it was done, as far as I'm sure you were concerned. This was the movie. This was it. We've worked 7 years on it, and we're moving along. What was it, though,
yeah,
that came across? Because, by the way, there's a lot of this is covered in an amazing documentary, Raiders, the story of the greatest fan film ever made, which is available on Netflix right now. But what was it that brought you back together to finish the one scene that you hadn't done, which was the airplane scene, which any fan of Raiders of the Lost Ark loves that scene. It's actually one of my favorites from the film, and I actually watched Raiders maybe it was 2 weeks ago. And it's just crazy how many iconic scenes are in that movie. But the airplane scene does stick out. What was the impetus that brought you back together? What was the catalyst, rather, that brought you back together to shoot the airplane scene?
Well, you know, that's the thing about Raiders. You know, this movie, I mean, as much as things drive us apart, Raiders has, you know, over kind of the arc of our lives has brought us back together again. Twice, you know, really, first was, after we finished our movie in 89 and went on to life and work and whatnot, our film was accidentally discovered, by Eli Roth and Harry Knowles and we met Spielberg and began, to tour with the film over a decade. And while we were touring, other folks, you know, loved the airplane scene too. And during Q&As would say, "Hey, love the movie, but I gotta say, what's there was one scene missing, the airplane scene. Why, you know?" And they explained, you know, back then we were limited resources, and of course the plane blows up at the end, and this is gonna sound funny, but we didn't want it to look cheesy. So it was the one thing that we didn't do, but on some level I think it always haunted me. I had, for no joke, for 5 years after we finished in 89, I had recurring dreams that we'd be shooting the airplane scene somewhere. So, so Chris and I, you know, life goes on and things kind of, and a book comes out, and, Chris and I are in touch, but not really collaborating on anything. And then, around the time that we're approached for, Jeremy Kuhn, producer of Napoleon Dynamite, star film at a screening in Utah, and approached us and asked to do a documentary. And we'd been approached by documentarians before, but it never, you know, it's never seemed like the right timing or whatnot, but this felt right. And around that time, Chris says to me, "You know, we should reunite everyone and do the airplane scene." And at first, actually, I dismissed it. I said, "No, I mean, do we really want the world, I mean, to think that all we're capable of doing is remaking Raiders?" So I was reluctant, actually, at first. But, you know, I got in thinking about it and in talking with Chris, I realized, you know, back when we were kids, we weren't concerned with what the world thought. We just did this for ourselves. And, you know, it was a kind of our love letter to the Spielberg original. And, well, look how that turned out. So we made a decision to lead to the original goal, which was for us to do it for ourselves and the way that we always wanted to do it, which was not cute, not, you know, not adorable, but as spectacular as we could pull off, you know, to do this because, hell, we wanted to do this thing since we were 12 years old, you know. Okay, I'm in. And so we did a Kickstarter campaign and raised $58,000 to do the airplane scene, this five-minute sequence. It's only 5 minutes, but my God, it is, yeah, having studied it thoroughly, I'm glad that we didn't even attempt it as kids. The danger of blowing up an airplane aside, which, by the way, we tried to blow up a scale model airplane back when we were kids as an experiment with a pipe bomb, and it didn't work. Thank God. We raised $58,000 to build a 78-foot wingspan aircraft replica of the flying wing in a mud pit in Van Cleve, Mississippi, and shoot it for 9 days. I'm a manager in a video game company at this point, and peak time off is parsed out very, very carefully. But I managed to I managed to get two blocks of time off, 3 days to fly down for a location scout, and then later 5 days off, which I can bracket with two weekends and create 9 days, 9 days to shoot 128 shots. I think we can do it. And we went for it. And that's how the airplane scene came to be.
Now, you hit on something there that I have to ask you about, because in the documentary, a large majority of it is focused on the shooting of the airplane scene and everything that it took in between that. And I have like a million questions about the airplane scene, but since you brought it up, I have to ask. You talk about the 5 days that you were let off from work, and you sandwiched that between the two weekends. That's 9 days. But it did not go according to plan. And there's a great quote in there by John Rhys-Davies that, you know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him you have a plan. And your plan was 9 days, and it went overtime. And you had to call your employer at the time and ask him for more time off. You had to ask him for additional days. And throughout the film, you hear you talk to your employer a few times at the time, and he was not too enthused with your aspirations to finish this project.
Hey, am I catching you at a good time?
I can talk. What's up?
Okay. Filming is gone well. We've overcome every obstacle except for one. We've been rained out for about half the days. And I'm calling to ask a favor, if there is any way that instead of me being back at the office Monday, 8 a.m., if you would permit me to return Wednesday, 8 a.m. I'm asking for two
more
days.
No, I don't think I can. I'm not gonna lie. I'm a little frustrated. I feel like we keep going back to this well, and you keep asking for more and more.
The rain is...
I know, yeah. But it's not my fault, the rain.
I understand, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's his livelihood. He gets a paycheck from that, but... You know, obviously this is what he wants to do, and for him to sort of go and have to beg for a single day.
For somebody who doesn't want to ask me to do this for you, you keep asking. Right?
Yep.
So, I need some time.
I understand.
I need some time. I'll take a look at it. I'll talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, I get asked about that part a lot, actually. It does seem to strike a chord with folks. What was going through my head was, I was very much aware that I was putting my employment at risk by calling, because it was not going to be received well, you know, shall we say. And, you know, I feel like, okay, I'm probably committing political suicide by doing this, but, you know, we needed desperately two more days. And so I made the decision to call and ask my boss for the two more days. And, but being there, being in the midst of, you know, I mean, if you've seen the documentary, you know, I mean, it was Herzogian out there, you know, so many people sacrifice so much. You know, my dear friend Maria worked on her birthday to build the tower and the straw hut. You know, people had really given of themselves to make the dream real. I mean, 781 Kickstarter backers aside, there's people that I grew up with in my hometown that just slaved with us in the pouring rain and the mud to make it happen. And I was going to just throw all that away for nothing. And I say nothing because, despite the emotional pressure that was put on me at the time, it was actually a very slow time at work. It was in the week of E3. For those of you familiar with the video game industry, that's where the whole industry is at, Electronics Entertainment Expo in LA Convention Center. And I would have returned to a graveyard shift type of pace, clicking through email and thinking about everyone who I'd let down. And I couldn't live with that. So I had to make the call, and my wife Cassie was thankfully really supportive in that. And the call was a bit of an emotional meat grinder, but ultimately my then boss grants me that. The conversation is actually a little softer than some of the harsher bits taken out. But bottom line, I was granted the 2 days and very glad and grateful. And we finished actually just under the wire. And I caught the last flight out of Gulf Florida. I made it into the office at 8 a.m. The following morning, Wednesday. And, you know, washing that red clay out in the shower, I mean, I felt changed. I'm just like, okay, I can't really go back to life as it was before, because as brutal and difficult as it was, my God, it was, I felt so alive, and I wasn't the only one, you know. You know, we had an amazing team and never got so much sleep, so little sleep, and such so much stress, but also so rewarding. So I think that was the beginning of a real shift. I mean, is it really in my best interest, you know, to have me sacrifice everyone's effort for nothing? And that's when I think, you know, a slow kind of gradual process, which would ultimately lead to my giving my former boss notice that, you know, I'm a professional, but it was time. PTO that I'd requested months in advance, and, you know, I'm a professional, but you don't own me. And that sort of philosophical divide, I think, was what ultimately led to my leaving. You know, so I'm happy with how it turned out. But that's not to say it wasn't stressful.
Well, you definitely, as a fan, you felt, as someone watching the film, you felt the pressure of that phone call. And like, it was just, I was filled with nervousness and anxiety just watching you dial the phone. As it started ringing, you could feel the tension through the screen. Now, I have to ask you, since a lot of the documentary focused on the airplane scene and the story of how you got there, obviously, but the airplane scene was so crucial, and it was really the heart of the documentary, and you wanted to see y'all pull it off so bad, and it just seemed like every obstacle that could have possibly been put in front of you was. You were rained out, this happened, then that happened. But one in particular, really, I talk about, you know, being nervous watching you dial a phone to talk to your former employer. The most nerve-wracking part of that documentary was when, here you are, you're ready to go, lights, camera, action, sounds rolling, you're getting ready to shoot the airplane scene. You got the one take to do it all the explosions and everything. And then all the pyrotechnics don't go off as they were supposed to. One doesn't go off. The plane doesn't blow up like it's supposed to. When that happened, what was going on in your mind?
So we're on the bluff, I call action, and yeah, there was this big buildup. We spent all morning taking, you know, hours and hours setting up the pyro, running the lines. And yeah, I call action. Chris and the Marion stunt double run out of the white line right on cue. The fuel truck blows up in the spectacular orange fireball, and supposed to be one beat, and then the plane doesn't go. And I'm like, oh. But I'm trying to just stay calm and figure out, okay, what can we do? And that's what was going through my mind at that moment.
And then the next moment is the pyrotechnics operator goes down, the expert goes down to check out the plane, see what he can do to make a big fireball so you can get your shot and y'all can put a wrap on this thing and finally finish this long process of shooting the airplane scene. Then he gets close, cameraman is following him. You're thinking, okay, we're going to get a good fireball, it's going to be all well and good. And then while he's just mere feet away from the plane, the pyro explodes and he goes flying backward. Then what was going on in your mind when you saw that happen?
This ear-splitting explosion. I see Dan's body be hurled and he ragdolls on the ground, and I jump to my feet and I say, is he okay? And And Francisco, my DP, sitting next to me, rises to his feet and says, no, he's not. And at that moment, my entire universe turns black. I mean, this moment was could be culmination of almost 35 years of love, you know, and passion to, you know, and it was going to be beautiful. And it, so my one word goes through my head and it's no, it can't all lead to this. It's not someone being hurt. And I jump off the bluff. And not before, actually, as I hear Francisco behind me saying, and we didn't get the shot. Because to back up a bit, you know, rewind briefly, when Dan goes down to the plane, I'm like, what's he doing down there? And I like, okay, well, I guess he knows what he's doing. Cut, you know, I had cameras 1, 2, and 3 all cut. So, you know, the cameras actually weren't rolling even when the plane exploded. And so Francisco says, he's not okay. And we didn't even get the shot. But can't think about any of that right now. I'm running towards Dan and the fire truck runs up and, you know, I get to him, you know, through the crowd and Dan's murmuring something. He's conscious and he says, Eric, did we get the shot? And I'm like, oh, God, I can tell he's going to be okay. He's, you know, I said, I actually, at this point, I don't think that we have, but I think I mutter, I haven't seen playback. I think we're okay. But, you know, I want to be encouraging, but Dan's okay. But God, is he, you know, we're going to rush in the hospital, make sure, hope he's okay. And then, you know, I wander back and then I see my first AD, Michael Mobley, walking towards me. And I can tell, okay, it's not good news. So he comes to me and says, we got the shot. So we, how? And turns out our first AD, Nick Ramey, a real pro and a hero that day, actually was forward thinking enough to reach up and hit record half a beat after the first explosion went. Dan told me later his body ragdolled because of his training, actually. Go low, you know, and you minimize the possibility of shrapnel or anything hitting you. And I think he passed out, you know, from the shock or the anxiety at that point. We rushed Dan to hospital and he got checked out with a clean bill of health 2 hours later. So thank God Dan's okay. But I can't tell you. Never forget that day or that moment, that instance. To know that, so I wander up to the bluff. So I've got to see my family, and I shared with everyone that Dan's okay, and we got the shot, and we went on to we had actually had pre-scheduled a wrap party that night, and as a crew and cast, we really needed it. You know, it was I think that event bonded us as in concrete, and Dan actually, you know, showed up about 20 minutes into thunderous applause. So happy ending. We seem to be continually lucky. And, you know, the real irony is that back when I decided to do the airplane scene, Chris and I, we told our wives, hey, don't worry. It's not going to be like when we're kids setting each other on fire. We're going to play it safe. Hire a professional pyrotechnician. What could go wrong? But it just goes to show you, Murphy's Law. It continues to be a Cinderella story. And for that, I'm so, so glad and feeling very, very lucky.
No, definitely. I mean, wow. What a moment that was in the documentary. Now, a couple more questions for you before we let you go, Eric. One of them is which you mentioned it earlier. You had a meeting with the great Steven Spielberg. You, Chris, had a meeting with him. How did that come about? One, and two, what happened in the meeting?
So we're in Los Angeles were scheduled to be on the Late Late Show with Craig Kilborn, driving down Sunset Boulevard, and we get a call from our agent at the time, he says Spielberg wants to meet you tomorrow at noon at Amblin on the Universal lot, and I can't believe it. Up to this point, a Vanity Fair article had come out, 10,000 words, and that's what led to, this attention. Prior to that, Harry Knowles' amazing review on Ain't It Cool News, which helped us get discovered. So all that chain of things led to us driving onto the Universal lot, up to the Amblin gates, which park like those big wooden gates in Jurassic Park, and go in and utter the most absurd words I've ever said in my entire life. Hi, we're here to see Mr. Spielberg, and not have it be a joke. But we sat down in this conference room and waited, for a couple minutes, drumming our fingers on the tabletop, looking at the honorary degrees on the walls, and in walks Steven Spielberg. And hey, boys, he was warm, paternal. It's really something to meet your boyhood hero, and even better to find that you've chosen your childhood hero as well. He couldn't have been nicer. Sat down, and only a few feet from the guy whose film I'd spent my entire childhood emulating, I got to talk to him directly. We talked for about 45 minutes about life, Raiders. I asked him, was it a good shoot? And he shared a background on that. The box set of the Indiana Jones trilogy had come out shortly before, and I lamented the absence of a particularly deleted scene that I knew of and hungered to see. And he said, well, I never put deleted scenes on my DVDs. I work really hard to create an illusion, and I don't want to undermine that. But I do have some outtakes from Raiders and Temple of Doom in my office. You guys want to see? Yeah. So in 5 minutes, we're sitting on a couch in Steven Spielberg's office, with headshots kind of, cluttered to one side, watching what I felt like only like the crew and cast back from the 80s had seen, these hilarious outtakes from Raiders and this one, and from Temple of Doom, one kind of vignette involved Barbara Streisand and whipping Harrison, dominatrix style, lashed to a rock on the set of Temple. It was something. And after that, he was even kind enough to grant our request for a photo. And just as we're walking out, Jason, who didn't worship Spielberg growing up as we did, he was more of a Jean Cocteau's Beating the Beast guy. He says, nevertheless, Mr. Spielberg, I just want to say, I don't care what anyone says. I liked The Color Purple. Jason, I know what he meant. There was some controversy at the time about a white director directing what some viewed as a black story. And that's what he meant. Mr. Spielberg, carried it off very well. Thank you. And we sort of stumbled out into the sunlight and wow, what just happened? So it was, that was the time that we got to meet our childhood hero.
Wow. And a few of us would be so lucky to meet our childhood idols and heroes and have them actually be everything that we thought that they would be. My last thing for you is, after the film comes out, the documentary comes out, I've seen the documentary now twice. I have the fan film, the remake, the actual film itself on DVD, and you leave your job that we talked about earlier. You decided to resign and focus full time on Rolling Boulder Films. Tell us, what is Rolling Boulder Films now? What are you working on, and what does the future hold?
Well, we just finished a 64 city tour in support of the documentary, now streaming on Netflix, as you noted. And there's a couple projects that Chris and I have been eyeing to work on that are currently, that we've optioned one and are looking looking to seek financing for that early yet, but hopefully with any luck, you'll see us back. No Temple of Doom the adaptation. Let me just get that out of the way. we're done with the remakes. More immediate, however, though, in trying to take charge of our lives, you know, and pursue things that are meaningful to us. You know, my wife and I, having completed the tour and showing the film and talking with some really amazing people over the past half year while on the road, we've been invited to a number of schools to kind of share our story and educate and hopefully inspire. You know, there's whether it's a film or a play or a blog or whatever, you know, teachers and educators have wanted us to kind of share that experience. And so we've actually just launched ZelaDetours.com, which is a website that'll in which we're going to go out there on the road and meet at schools, you know, middle schools, high schools, colleges, and share and hopefully inspire folks as we ourselves were inspired to, you know, to pursue their dreams, whatever that is. And even if it's challenging, even if it's scary sometimes, you know, all the while we're working on other projects in the meantime. So that's what we've got. Oh, and there's actually one final tour stop. It's actually later on this month. There's a Comic-Con themed cruise to Cozumel, Mexico and Key West that I'll be on and would love to see folks there. I'm introducing a double feature of the Doc and the Fan film. It's called fan2c.com, two being the number two.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for your time. An incredible story, an incredible ride, I'm sure. And we look forward to what Rolling Boulder Films brings us in the future. But until then, thank you so much for your time, and we really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Brad.
Oh, Brad, what have you done now?